Hi, everybody. I'm Julianne. I'm an alcoholic. Let's have an AA meeting. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I do not know tonight's speaker other than her name is Care W, and I know that she's from the 730 group. Oh, you? I knew you as Karen. Huh? Karen? All right, well, there you go. It's an anonymous program, I guess. I do know her, and I'm happy to introduce her. Here she comes.
Thank you. Wow. That is totally awesome. My home group, a lot of representation here tonight. Thank you so much for showing up, each and every one of you. I haven't actually told my story like this for a number of years, so hopefully we'll get through it without too much anguish. Hopefully nobody will take a drink. And I'm just going to share my experience, strength, and hope. It gets a little, it's a bad story, but God redeemed a lot of good out of it, so I'm going to try not to dwell on the past very much. And I think I'm supposed to have like 40 minutes or so, 40 minutes, Tim said. So, and what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. My name is Care W., and I am an alcoholic. Hi, fellowship. And I really realized I wrote out a little format, and as I was writing it out, I thought, I really am an alcoholic. Yeah, I've been sober. March 27th was 31 years of sobriety. And I've been coming to this clubhouse that whole time. Of course, I go to meetings in other places, too, but this has been a part of my whole recovery, and I'm grateful for NABA. So it provided a good shelter for me when I started out, and still does. I love the people that come here, and if you're not a member of the club, I would encourage you to look into that when you can. It's a safe haven. I was raised by terrorists. They terrorized me every day. I had one little brother who also... my mother was mentally ill, and I'm not exactly sure what her diagnosis was, but she was seriously mentally ill, and she was very violent. And then my dad was the alcoholic. Now, I didn't really have labels for any of these things until I got into recovery. I was just a little kid, and there was a lot of abuse in the home. I was beaten periodically by both my parents. I was molested by my father. The first time he was, I mean, I'm sure any of the stuff that he did, he was drunk. That doesn't excuse it. It was just what happened. And so I was remembering back a lot of the messages I got from my mother. I had to laugh tonight because I thought, well, was she like a drill sergeant? Because she would say, get your fingers out of your mouth. I bit my nails, you know? I mean, it was a lot of anxiety growing up the way I did, so I'm not surprised. I'm going like, wow. And get your shoulders back and suck your stomach in and get your hair out of your face. I mean, if she was here today, she'd be saying, get your hair out of your face. Fortunately, most of my family is deceased, so, which is, yeah, it's a good thing. My little brother, he did commit suicide. He did kill himself. And that was kind of like when I got into recovery, I'm going like, yeah, I really am from a dysfunctional family, you know. So I came by my dysfunction, honestly. And I was told a lot that I was a mistake, that I was never meant to be born, that my little brother was planned for. But I think a lot of that I was bad. And I did have some bad behaviors. Once when I was 13, my mother thought I was an extension of her for some reason, and she was always surprised when I didn't act like she wanted me to act. And so she actually took me to a psychiatrist, and he interviewed my whole family, and I remembered, you know, some of the strange questions he asked me. But at the end of everything, he told my mother the wind-up. He said that really he didn't find anything wrong with me, but that he found something wrong with her. And that was so validating for me to hear as a kid, like, wow, I knew it. But unfortunately, on her way home from that results or whatever it was, she had an automobile accident. She ran a red light. It was raining, and she was crying, and she ran a red light and ran into a station wagon, and the mother of six children was killed instantly. So that became my fault. I mean, I was the family scapegoat. My mother had epilepsy. That was my fault because she developed it when she was pregnant with me. Now, you know, that's idiotic, but a little kid, you don't know this stuff. I mean, I couldn't help but take on that shame and that the insanity of the disease. And my dad being the drunk, my mom would do things like, once she wrapped him in a sheet and beat him with a broom, trying to get him sober, you know, and it didn't work. So, and then when I was 13, my first, I'd had a couple of minor brushes with the law at 13. We lived on the beach and had a curfew violation. The police picked me up. But I was already, like, so hardened. Like, they ask you, whenever you're arrested, they ask you if you have any tattoos or birthmarks or identifying things, you know. I go, yeah, I have a battleship tattooed on my chest. And I was 13, you know, so I was like, they didn't believe me. And I didn't really grow up to be a hardened criminal, but I had no regard for laws at all. I just thought I could do whatever. Once I left home, I met my husband-to-be. I was 17. He'd just gotten out of prison. And that was like, you know, that was a good job recommendation. I mean, he had muscles. He had tattoos. He was an armed robber. I thought he could keep me safe. He was better than my parents, you know. I mean, he was nice to me, at least, you know, starting out. I mean, he never did hit me or anything, but, you know, I mean, how was I supposed to make healthy choices? I was very sick. Well, he didn't live very long. My family traveled a lot. My dad was in construction, and so we'd just go to the next place where there was a big job and for him to do. And then when I got married, my husband traveled. So we went up to Michigan, and he was killed in an automobile accident. He was killed instantly. But things were not going very well with us, as you might imagine. You know, with him being an armed robber and me being crazy. I didn't really drink very much when I was married because he was sort of my fix. It was sort of like, oh, somebody wants me, I'm probably okay. And when my last words to him before he died were, I hate you, get out of my life, I wish you were dead. Well, he had a girlfriend, is one of the reasons I was upset with him, because I found some love letters. And so that's why I just said, you know, leave me alone. And he left and he went to her. And within 12 hours, he had rented a house like around the corner from the house that I lived in, and he was going to move in there with her. But he was killed on the interstate, and she was in the car behind him. So when the police came to my door to ask me to come to the hospital to identify his body, she was in the car with like blood on her and crying and just drama. My life just had all this drama. And then I called my mother, my supportive mother, and I said, Mom, you know, Dexter was just killed in an automobile accident. And she goes, well, I'm sure it was God's will, and don't think you're coming here. And I'm going like, why did I call her, you know? I mean, why would I? I just really didn't have good sense. So anyways, my husband died. I was about 20 now, and we had a child. I think she was like one and a half years old. And so now I'm in Michigan, and what am I going to do? I got some insurance money because he was in the union. And I bought a Mustang, of course, with that money. What else are you going to do? Really hot tires. And so anyways, and I'm not really real clear on why I left Michigan, but I think it had something to do with they were getting ready to take my driver's license away. And Well, also I found out that my husband was married before he was married to me and not divorced. And so his real wife, got the property that we had, or it was tied up in court. And so I didn't really want to, be there for all that. So I just left town because that's what we just moved around a lot. So I moved around, moved to Florida for a little while, and that didn't work out very well. And then and the day that my husband died is the day I started what I would call my alcoholic drinking career. In Michigan, you can go get alcohol from the corner grocery stores. And so I just walked down there, and I got, I guess, a fifth or a quart of vodka. And I would hold my nose and just start drinking it. And I just needed the effect. And I just, had this child I had to take care of, but I could not stand the way I felt. And I will tell you, from growing up in the household that I did, I hated myself. I really did think, I tried to strangle myself when I was like 8. You can't really, I really hated myself. I wanted to be different than how I was. But, I just had no self-esteem. I had no feeling of worth. I was told I was worthless probably, 300 times, when I was a little kid. And I just really kind of believed it. I mean, maybe everybody believes that. I don't know. But I know a lot of alcoholics do believe that. But, by the time I got to Arizona, I started trying to figure out how I was going to support myself. So naturally, bars looked like a good idea. And I got a job in a college bar that the guy taught me how to bartend. And, college bars, they drink a lot of things like Brandy Alexanders and Pink Ladies, stuff like that. But the thing was that I could get alcohol. So, and then I also got a job in one of the downtown clubs. And I don't know if any of y'all know about how downtown clubs are, but they only close like for an hour to spray out the floor because for that 1 hour, then all the winos would come, wait at the door for, to get wine. They sold wine there to go. And I didn't last there very long. It was a pretty rough crowd, but I learned some, tricks. And I was just trying to make money, however. Bartending, you can... And plus, I was, stealing from people. When they would get drunk, I would just take their money. I wasn't honest. I was just trying to get by. I did get Social Security for my child. So that really, that paid the rent. So I only had to worry about, food and all that other stuff. So Arizona, now I want to tell y'all, it's right next door to Nogales. And Bacardi is pretty cheap over there, and plus all the other stuff like, weed and hash and all this other. Well, anyway, so I enlarged my capacity for getting high. Started just, trying out other things. And, I had a bad automobile accident, so I had to leave town. And then I went... Where did I go after that? Before they took my driver's license away, I just... Back then, you really could just go state to state and say, oh, hi, I want a driver's license. I've never had one. And, you just get one. I'm kind of old, so... I think I went back to Florida briefly, but somehow I met a friend in Arizona. She was a cosmetologist that worked next door to the bar. And so she wanted to leave Arizona, so we decided to go to Florida, and then that didn't work out, and then so we decided to come to Atlanta. And so we got here, and I got here like the end of 1969, the beginning of 1970, which was just prime time hippie days. And I drove down Peachtree Street, and there were all these like wild looking people with like wearing flags and long hair and bread, leather. And my first thought was, wow, this is where I belong. I would not stand out in this crowd. And I just always felt like I stood out, it was called self-centeredness, but like everybody's always looking at me. Well, I figured I'd be safe in that crowd. And I just, and I thought, and then plus they're all yelling, they're selling drugs out there. And I thought, really? And they really were. They really were doing that. So that one didn't take too long. I think that from I think that 24 to 26 was about when I lived right by Piedmont Park. I was age 24 through 26. And so not only, and yes, I started drinking like Ripple wine and just, you know, but mainly I was using a lot of other drugs other than alcohol. And then, I mean, I had more money than most of the kids on the block, so I started selling drugs because it was easy and it was money. And then I started getting arrested a lot more. And so somehow I don't really know how many times I've been arrested. I tried to count them once. I really don't know. They would just come down there and clean up the street, and sometimes I was in the crowd and sometimes I wasn't. And then, you know, where I lived got busted a couple of times. And then I was on probation when the big idea was presented to me to go to South America and bring back some cocaine. And it's really cheap over there. And so, and then plus I was a user, you know, I had been using regularly for about a year, and it sounded like a good idea. What did I know? And so, I mean, back then you could buy like a kilo of uncut stuff for $300. But the hard part is getting it back. So I was not successful at that. That was pretty scary. I pretended I couldn't speak English when they arrested me. I would just say no English, and they put me in Dade County Jail. They got me at, you know, Miami International with a kilo of cocaine on my body, and the guy that sold me the stuff turned me in. He made more money turning me in than they did selling me the stuff. And don't do drugs. No, don't drink. Anyway, so I will tell you this little brief story about when they locked me up. Of course, the news crews were there, and they put me in this cell with like 40 women. And they all go like, "Why are you in here? What's going on?" I don't know. No, you know, I don't know. Where were you? I was at the airport. Well, what were you doing? I don't know. It's something about immigrations. I don't know what they're doing. So there was a TV set in that jail cell, and then all of a sudden the news comes on, and there I am. And they said, "Oh, this curvy young lass was arrested at the airport with a kilo of cocaine on her body." And then all those women looked at me and just said, "Well, now do you know why you're in here?" And that was a very scary moment. They wanted to know if I had any. No. Well, anyway, so I did, you know, of course, get out of jail and on bond. But because I had already quite a few arrests, you know, locally, they gave me a committed sentence, and it was a federal, you know, charge. So I got committed to the same institution that Martha Stewart got sent to, up in West Virginia. And really, I tell you what, it was nice. It was very nice. I mean, if you were raised with my family, no, look, I'm serious. Here I was getting, I had a nice room. I mean, they really, I had it locked on the inside. Well, actually, after a very short time, they saw that I was, you know, I don't know, kind of good. So they put me in the honor cottage, and where you're kind of self-governing. And but the only thing was, I didn't really have a release date. That kind of bothered me. And then this thing about stir crazy, it really does happen. I started I became afraid to leave my room. And, you know, when I got there, they said, "You're here as punishment, not for punishment. We'll try to make your stay as nice as possible." They really said those words. I'm going like, wow. And, you know, I got medical care. I got food. I met some other druggies. I mean, it was fun, you know. I mean, Afghanistan girl and Jewish girl from California with a bunch of reefer. I mean, bank robbers. I mean, it was interesting. Well, I only stayed there about a year. They released me to a halfway house in Florida. And then, you know, I really, looking back on this story, I really see that God was really with me the whole time. I mean, there were so many things that could have happened to me that didn't. You know, when I got out of prison now, the big P word, God had a job lined up for me, actually working with a doctor. I mean, somebody just said, hey, I heard that Kara got out of prison. Does she need a job? And I didn't really want to, you know, I wanted to go straight. And I got a job in a strip joint, actually. My parole officer said he didn't think it was a good idea, but I said, well, I got to make a living. And, well, the first time I got tipped was stolen bank money. I started thinking, like, yeah, this might not be a good place for me, bank robbers, you know. And I wasn't, you know, I figured alcohol's legal, you know. So I got a job working in this doctor's office, and I gave up the strip club, but then I started tending bar on the weekends at a really upscale restaurant to try to make ends meet. So I just was in a holding pattern for about 8 years, just drinking. You know, my parole officer, he'd come over like once a month. I'd be drunk. And one time he said, what are your goals? And I said, what are yours? And he goes, I mean, what is a goal? I didn't even know what a goal was. And he goes, well, I want a house on the lake and a speedboat and all that. And I said, well, good for you, buddy. I'm just trying to make it through the day. And so, you know, liquor was legal. And so I successfully completed my probation. Actually, I have not been arrested, you know, since then. So that's good. I haven't even gotten a, you know, like a speeding ticket or anything. That's God. So I started, you know, just drinking all the time because it was legal. And the woman I worked with, her husband's still sober now, Don. He's got like 45 years now. She had broken his anonymity to me at work, saying, you know, I would come in and I would say, do you think I drink too much? And she was Al-Anon. You know, she would go like, well, what do you think? And I would go, nah. And that went on for a couple of years, I think. Because, I mean, I would come to work. You know, I'd been out till maybe 4 in the morning. And I'd still come to work like at 8 or whatever. And in function somehow. So, but when it was time, and here's how it got time. This is my part of my first step, I guess. I was dating this guy. And he came over one Saturday morning, and he didn't drink. He just did drugs. So, but it was 9 o'clock, and he went to take a drink of my what he thought was like Coke, and it was, you know, rum and Coke. And he goes like, "Oh, this is alcohol at 9 o'clock in the morning. I think you're an alcoholic." And I went, "What? No." I said, oh, I get it. You think that I just woke up and started drinking. I said, no, I've been up all night drinking. But he said, you know, I think you need to go to AA. Well, nobody had ever said those. Nobody ever told me I was an alcoholic. Nobody ever said those words. I didn't even know what that meant. I went to work and I asked Charlene, where does your husband go to those meetings? Because really I was having a lot of problems. I had been having a lot of problems my whole life. But that time I was having financial problems. My hands were shaking like this and my armpits were sweaty. And of course I have boyfriend problems. Can you imagine that? And my child, you know, I told you I had a child. By this time, now she's 16, and guess what? I found drugs in her room. I found, like, joints in her purse. I found, you know, cocaine in her. I couldn't have that, because if she's going to have drugs in her room, if the police busted the place, they would take me away. They would think it was mine. And, you know, I really only mainly drank after that, except if I went to a party or if I was exposed to, you know, I didn't have a real good plan in place to say no, but at least, you know, I felt that was doing pretty legal. So I asked her, Charlene, where her husband went to those meetings. She goes, oh, you're in luck, there's a meeting, and it's in your neighborhood tonight at 8 o'clock. Well, it's in everybody's neighborhood at 8 o'clock. Skyland. And she goes, oh, my husband will be there. He'll meet you at the door. So I said, okay. And I finished off the bottle that I had before I went, you know, over to that meeting for courage to go. And I wasn't drunk. You know, I just drank the rest of that bottle. And he met me at the door, and we went to the meeting. And I don't remember anything about it except I was kind of sitting in the middle of the room. Bunch of people sitting around. I don't remember anything that was said. But at the end of the meeting, everybody said, oh, it's so good you're here. Blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, well, what do I do now? And they said, well, don't drink and go to meetings. And I went, well, where do I go? And so somebody said, oh, let's get you a meeting schedule. And so then I said, where's one on here? And they showed me Toco Hills, actually, was next. I think it was on Wednesday. So I went there, and then, well, what do I do? Actually, there, a good friend of mine, who really wasn't an alcoholic, her roommate was celebrating 1 year at that meeting. And Nancy, and so I went up to her and I said, like, what are you doing here? And she goes, like, I'm getting sober. What are you doing here? And I'm like, well, I don't know. I just, you know, I didn't know what I was doing there because I hadn't picked up a chip. I hadn't even heard about the chips. And that boyfriend, if you want to call him that, he kept calling me like every day. Did you go to a meeting? I'm going like, yeah. How many people got white chips? I'm going like, what's that? And they're like, oh, they give them out at the meeting. I'm going like, okay, I don't know. Next day he called me. You go to a meeting? Yep. How many people got white chips? I'm going like, none, nobody. He goes, oh, okay. Third day. Well, it was Friday night, back to Skyland. And Nancy was there again. Did you get a white chip yet? I'm going like, what is all this white chip stuff? She goes like, well, get a white chip. And I said, why? And she said, you know, they're for you. And I said, they're for me. So I thought, okay, whatever. And then when I got one, everybody went, yay! And so it seemed like pretty easy. You know what, though? I'm just a one white chipper person. I mean, that doesn't, you know, you can get as many white chips as you want. It doesn't matter when the miracle happens. But I just happened to, for some, I mean, it was time. It was just time. God's hand was just on me, and I was just willing. And then I was just willing to start following directions, which I'd never done in my life. And so I would just start asking people what, you know, now if people talked at a meeting and they sounded like they might have known this God stuff, you know, I would say, well, what's that? 30 days sober, this guy that I was dating, I saw he came to a meeting with a girl. And it wasn't, you know, they were like, she was rubbing his back, and I was, of course, flipping out. I was very emotionally immature, if you can imagine. I mean, I really didn't have feelings. From the time my husband died, I either drank them away, smoked them away, had sex them away, shopped them away, whatever. But I just couldn't live with my insides. So that was, you know, I was pretty ballistic over that. And after the meeting was over, I'm going straight to that liquor store. And then all of a sudden, on the way to the liquor store, it said, oh, by 30 days, I had heard some people say that they got on their knees and asked God to... Now, I didn't believe in God, but I thought, well, what do I have to lose? I'll go try that first, and then if it doesn't work, then I'll go to the liquor store. So I went home. I just hit the love seat, got down on my knees, and I just said, God, you know, if you're really there, those people in AA say that you're here, and so, you know, how long is this going to take? But I don't really want to drink, so what am I supposed to do? I just kind of like hung out there for, I don't know how long it was. Nothing happened. I mean, you know, I was expecting something. But what did happen, which went unnoticed by me, is I didn't drink. I went upstairs and went to bed, went to sleep. And it wasn't until like a year and a half later that I went, oh, that was God doing for me. You know, going from highly agitated, I'm going to drink, I'm crazy, to sleeping. You know, that's pretty remarkable. So I came to meetings for the first 2.5 months. And I came to small meetings. Everybody had to share. And I would just say, I have a desire not to drink, because I really didn't think I was an alcoholic. I really did. You know, you've heard of denial. I mean, I was in denial. I just didn't. I think I was in denial until yesterday when I looked at my history like, oh, my God, I drank all the time. You know, I stole, when I was 16, I went to a dance and stole purses to get ID so I could buy my own liquor. I mean, that's, you know, that might be an indication that alcohol is important to your life. Well, I did get caught. I did get caught with a bottle of alcohol in my room when I was 16. And those crazy parents of mine, they said, "Where did you get that?" And I said, "Well, I bought it at the liquor store."
"That is against the law, and we're taking you to the police."
And they took me to the police, and they begged them to send me away. And you know what the police told them? They, I guess, looked up my record, and they said, my school record. "Oh, she attends school. She makes good grades. She's not bad enough. We can't do anything with her." So that was validation, too, you know? I mean, they really did not like me. My parents did not like me. So, but anyways, I like me today because of this program and because of you all like me, too. Some of you do. I know it. So, don't drink. Go to meetings. 2.5 months not drinking. I was really liking it here. I was starting to worry, like, oh, no, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I can't come here. And I was in the laundromat on a Saturday morning down the street. I live close by here. And I'm reading the 12 and 12, and I'm drinking. I still have my big Buckhead Saloon orange cup that I drank out of, but it didn't have liquor in it. And I was still going to bars, too, by the way. I just wasn't drinking in the bars, but I was, you know, I was trying to do both. Didn't want to lose my friends out there. But y'all were just so much more interesting. I mean, you're saying some real good stuff in here, you know? And so I thought maybe I should probably stop going to the bars and just stay in here. And so I looked around that laundromat, and there were a lot of people in there. Nobody was drinking liquor. Nobody was reading AA literature. And I went, I think I'm an alcoholic. I mean, the moment of reckoning, you know, that's when I finally just fully accepted that I was an alcoholic. So I quit saying I had a desire not to drink, because that is the third tradition. You can't kick me out because if I'm not an alcoholic, I have a desire not to drink. I got a lot of flack, believe me. You come in here and you keep saying, well, I don't know, I have a desire not to drink. Some people do not like you saying that. And then, like, this one woman, she kept going like, well, why don't you just go on out of here and drink? And I'm going like, well, I don't want to drink today. And, I mean, we're allowed to drink. We can do that. That's a choice. I mean, I get to make a choice today. I didn't have a choice when I came in here, but I have a choice now. And I don't want that stuff back. Once I started getting healing in here and these steps, like, oh, I wanted to read to you. I love this on page 24 of this book. I love this book. It's so... The first time I read it, I was like, what is this? That guy gave it to me. He gave me a big book. He said he thought it would help me. I'm going, oh, he wanted me to read it to him. That's what he said. Here, read this book to me. And I was going like, what? You can't make this stuff up, I'm telling you. Anyway, he said he needed help. Anyway, on page 25, it says, the great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. And the central fact of my life today is the absolute certainty that my Creator has entered my heart and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous and has commenced to accomplish those things for me which I could never do by myself. So, I told you I haven't been arrested, you know, since back then. I don't even steal now. I've lost my teeth. I'm honest. If I try not to find anything anymore. That's sort of like legal stealing. You find something, like a cell phone. I have found cell phones. But then it's like, well, what do I do with it? I take it home. What do I do with this? And so I just thought, well, I don't need a cell phone. I mean, it just gets, like, it's a problem for me finding stuff. I did take it to Verizon and turn it in, but I wish I just left it laying there, you know? I mean, this first step, rigorous honesty, that's what y'all told me, too, when I first got here, that if I wasn't honest, I wasn't going to be able to stay sober. Well, I had never been honest. I mean, I had I didn't have cash register honesty. I didn't have emotional honesty. I didn't even know who I was. I didn't even know if I even had a favorite color, what color it was. I do have favorite colors today, so, and I'm honest today. That change happened inside me. This stuff that happens to the result of these steps happened, you know, inside me. One of the phenomenal, all the steps are phenomenal, but, like, my first first fourth step was actually, it just read like a criminal indictment. It was a long list of things I had stolen over some period of time. And my sponsor, and I had a sponsor, said, how did you feel about this? And well, I'm like, I don't know, I guess good. Nothing had changed with me. I mean, this process takes time. And in order to be able to see patterns and character defects, and I mean, I was really sick. It took about, I was 16 months sober before I could do that real fearless and thorough fourth step and be able to list things like resentments and hurts our secrets keep us sick. I would pretty much blab to anybody about anything, so I wasn't really all that secretive about anything, but when I started that, about an hour into that fifth step, she started crying, and I went, whoa, what's the matter? And she said, I was talking about things that happened to me as a child, and she said, can't you have some compassion for the child that you were? I didn't know what the word compassion meant. I mean, I came in here, I didn't know what half the words we use, like unconditional love and mercy and grace and faith and hope, and I didn't have those in my vocabulary. And it was a gradual process of learning. So I asked her, what is compassion? She said, well, and this really helped me a lot. She said, what if this story you had just told me, what if you were watching it on a movie screen and all of a sudden it hit me? It's like totally depersonalized it. Oh, if it happened to somebody else, oh, it was bad. But if it happened to me, oh, that's nothing. I minimized everything. I guess to get through the stuff, That first fearless and thorough one, the next meeting I came to, it was in this room, and actually there was a podium over there, and somebody asked me to read the 12 traditions, and I got up there, and my legs were just shaking like this. And I'm going like, what's wrong with me? And she told me afterwards, she said, working that step stripped away all those walls that I had built up, that hard little turtle covering that said, I have a battleship tattooed on my chest to the police at 13. That stuff was gone. I'm real now. I'm a real vulnerable feeling human being. I've learned to live with my feelings. I really hope that especially if you're new and struggling with stuff, that you just give yourself some time and don't pick up, no matter, even if your ass falls off, you don't pick up, you just keep coming back to meetings, you make phone calls, you read literature, you pray, we have so many spiritual tools in here. I've done many fourth and fifth steps. I told you I was sexually abused as a child, and my relationship with men was not very good because of that stuff. I just used people. I used everybody. I didn't care. I just felt so needy, and I was just a taker, just because it was all about me, give it. I was a pickpocket for a while, if you can imagine that. I mean, picking people's pockets, for me. It amazes me today that some of the stuff that I did. Statute of limitations is over, so, I don't care. But that fifth step about the sexual abuse, after that step, my relationship with every man on the planet changed. And here's how I recognized it. I was back at that coffee pot getting a cup of coffee, and some guy came up to me. Normally, I was just inside. I was just all, like, tense and tight. And this guy came up and said, hey, how you doing? I said, oh, good. And I just kind of leaned into him, And I'm going like, whoa, what's that? There was no... I had lost that fear that I had of men. I had this fear, I guess, my whole life, and it was gone because of steps 4 and 5. And 6 and 7, one remarkable thing, which some of y'all may not like this, but I also had a character defect of sexual lust. And, when we start praying that asking God to remove our character defects, he actually sometimes does. And how I found out about the lust thing is I was sitting in the meeting with some female, and this guy comes in. She goes, oh, look at that hot guy. And I'm going, what? And I didn't see any hot guys. And that's when I realized that that was just my whole thinking. I started just seeing guys as people now. You know, you weren't objects anymore. I know you guys objectify females too, so it's not just us that does that. Y'all do that too. But I thought that was another thing. I told you I didn't think I had any worth, except I thought I had a little bit of sexual worth, okay? You know, maybe I'm good for sex. How pitiful is that? Yeah, I'm a child of God and a person of worth. And you know what today? This program, God has... I mean, I love myself today. I respect myself today because I do respectable things. When I was 50, God turned me into an engineer, not the choo-choo train kind, but I'm a civil engineer. I had a lot of on-the-job training, and I've been promoted. I've gotten, awards. I have this one, the Commissioner's Merit Award. It's this big hunk of plexiglass that has my name engraved on it for, meritorious service. I actually work. I mean, I work and do I'm smart, which I was told I was stupid. Some of my actions were stupid, yes. But I've got a good brain. And even doing all that stuff did not kill my brain. I mean, some brain cells, I'm sure, died. However, you know, that I can stand up here and tell you all this stuff about my life. The 11th step, I practiced that thing when I was newer. I still do all this stuff. Just because I've been sober 31 years does not mean I don't, still work a recovery program. I mean, it's a daily reprieve. So that's all, you know, I have. Plus, I had a lot of other addictions when I came in here. So I'm pretty high maintenance. I have to do this stuff if I want to stay sane. I have to continue to work the steps. I'm not talking about real formal, but if I'm having a problem, I have to think okay, is this a character defect? Is it, you know, am I not accepting something? The gong show is about to happen. I did want to also tell y'all about the acceptance pamphlet that I think I see it back there in that literature counter. It was very helpful to me in my first year of sobriety. I studied that thing every single day. I would read parts of it because I guess that a big part of my disease was lack of acceptance of anything. So, it's a spiritual principle to accept the things you can't change. I mean, you can't just make yourself do that. God's really in charge of that stuff. I mean, He's in charge of all this stuff. I wouldn't be standing up here, you know, if there wasn't a loving God. You can't get from where I was to where I am today. You can't get there. One of the things God did with me, besides turn me into an engineer, that always sounds like, bing, you're an engineer, but He didn't really do it like that. But, you know, that child that I had, she didn't turn out very well. And she had a child that her and her husband both, you know, were just really heavily into drugs, and I started trying to save this child. Well, anyways, the child came to live with me when she was 5, and I raised her. I raised her. Now she's 28 today, and she, you know, she credits me for having a good life because her mama's still out there. I mean, she's out of jail right now. She's been in and out of jail my whole recovery, and you know, she's out right now, so that's, kind of a change. I mean, but I've had to learn to live with all that stuff. And then, you know, raising that child. And then my granddaughter, now I have a great-grand that I'm helping, you know, with her. And, you know, God's used my life. You know, I've sponsored probably about 75 women. And it's time to close, but I want to tell you this one funny story about, I was downstairs. We used to have the hotline down there, and people would call. Well, I think they still do. Call for help. Well, a pilot he'd been out of town for 2 weeks, came back home, found his wife had been in bed drinking for 2 weeks, and he called here for help. Well, I had had leg surgery, so I was on crutches, and another woman, Beverly, said, well, I'll drive, we'll go over there. Well, she dropped me off. It was a gated community, and we got in, and she dropped me off while she went to park the car, and I hobbled up to the front door and rang the doorbell, and this pilot comes to the doorbell, and he stops and he looks me up and down and he goes, are you all they had? Okay, guys. All right. Well, listen, you've been great. I love you all. Thank you so much for listening to me. And You know, if you want to give me hugs after the meeting, I would really like that, because I put a lot of stuff out there, so I like good support, and so thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Kara. That was incredible. And I apologize, but 19 years I thought your name was Karen. This program is amazing. I mean, it's just amazing. It doesn't really matter what our names are, does it? What we learn from each other.
We'll all be together on that broad highway.